Today's episode comes not from Silicon Valley, but from Egypt. Population? 105 million, making it the third most populous country in all of Africa. The capital? Cairo. Language? Arabic. And top exports? Petroleum products and precious metals like gold, copper, silver, zinc, and platinum. All right, I know what you're thinking. Another grocery delivery app? I mean, come on. DoorDash, Seamless, InstaShop, Instacart, Talabat, Swiggy, Uber Eats, Delivery Hero. Man, wherever you are in the world, chances are you can order your groceries from home at the click of a button. But it's not just the App Store where we're drowning in grocery delivery options. Have you read through TechCrunch lately? I mean, it's a race. No, a full-out sprint amongst grocery delivery startups, promising you your groceries in as little time as possible. That is, as soon as one raises like, I don't know, $1 trillion to get you your groceries in 10 minutes, another one comes along promising you your groceries in 9. It's insane. Really. And for Ahmed Yusri and Rabbit in Egypt, well, to call a spade, it's been more of the same. They had the pre-seed herd all around the world last year, $11 million before even launching. The biggest pre-seed in the history of the entire Middle East. But Rabbit's story, Ahmed's story, it's not just yet another case study on raising money fast or delivering milk and bread fast, but rather building fast. It took he and his team 130 days. Yep, 130 days between coming up with the idea for Rabbit and making Rabbit's first delivery. He's helped put Egypt, well, on the damn map and in the process, inspiring a generation of Egyptians to dream big and move quick, like a rabbit. I'm David Sibinski.
And I'm Ahmed Yusri.
And this is Not From Silicon Valley. Ahmed, I want to get right into the business part of your story. A, because it happened so damn fast, which listeners will hear about, and B, because, well, it's so damn fascinating. So you're born and raised in Cairo, you go to university in nearby Fayoum, and you graduate with a degree in engineering. Why engineering?
So I was an electronics and communication engineer. And the reason why I got into engineering in the first place was my grandmother. She had one of those old school TVs, and my job was to switch channels, and I was the master of the knob. And then one day she got one of those newer TVs with a remote control, and for me, it was mind-blowing. I was 7, 8 years old, and all of a sudden, she felt like a magician. She could change channels from across the room, and I just couldn't let that go. So I took that remote apart when she was sleeping, and I found that little bulb at the end, and I thought, this must do something. And accordingly, this piqued my curiosity. A couple of years later, my parents took me to Disneyland, and I was on It's a Small World After All, the ride. My sister was loving it. My dad, my mother were just enjoying the music. And I was looking, this is the railing, and this is where the lights are coming from, and this is the projector. And it just sparked a very curious mind. I didn't enjoy the trip. I didn't enjoy the ride, but I enjoyed the mechanics of how they made it work. So all of this drove me to go into engineering school.
So for that diploma on your wall, you've got to thank your grandmother and her TV remote, and It's a Small World.
It's a Small World After All, yeah.
Unreal, man. All right, so you graduate with this engineering degree. What was the first gig at a university?
I kept searching, and a couple of friends of mine called me and told me there was an internship for a year at one of the telco companies, but it was as a software developer. I went in, I got the job, and it was a one-year contractor position. I had no idea what software development was about. So I went in, spent 3 months on W3 schools with a notebook, trying to learn how to code on a notebook. And after those 3 months, I became a decent coder.
A notebook? When was this?
That was 2006. You're making me feel old now.
16 years ago, man. Yeah. So how was your foray into software development?
I had no idea what software development was about. I was familiar with the term. I had 2 classes in university, but it wasn't nearly enough to build the tech they were asking me to build back in the day. I was asked to build intranets and collaboration tools for the company. And I had no idea how to do HTML. So yeah, I had to learn from the ground up on a free website and over a notebook. And then after a year, little did I know that this small year is going to have a very profound impact on my life, because till this day, I really go back to my roots of how to write code and how to evaluate tech and products. And it has helped me till this day. But again, going through the flow, after a year, I applied to Vodafone to become a networks engineer, which is my career and my degree. Through the interview process, HR told me, hey, we have good news and bad news. The bad news is the position was just filled. We have no position for you. But the good news is we have an opening in marketing that we think you're going to be perfect for. And I had no idea what marketing was.
Of course not. You weren't thinking about It's a Small World after all because of how Disney marketed it. You were thinking about the ride's nuts and bolts.
The machines. Yeah, but I had no other positions. So basically, it was the other gig was coming to an end and I was trying to find a position. So I thought, you know what, I'll give it a go. I went through the interview same day and then came back home and told my mother, hey, I went through the interview. They told me the position was no longer there, but they gave me an opportunity to apply to marketing. And she cried. I remember she thought that I'm going to throw my life away. I'm going to stand by the curb and try to sell SIM cards. And my engineering degree was going to go to waste. And to this day, I had no idea, until this moment, I had no idea what marketing was about. I told you my dad is a physician. My mother is a pharmacist. Already being an engineer was straying off the path. So, but again, I ended up taking the position.
And
it was the luckiest moment in my career because this single moment changed who I am. I turned into, I spent 9 years with Vodafone in Cairo, doing all sorts of different product marketing, brand and comms and CRM. Then I moved to London to look after the Center of Excellence for CRM for South Europe, Africa and Asia.
London, huh?
Yeah. And that job took me around the world. It took me to places like Nigeria, spent 6 months in Malaysia, a couple of months in Vietnam, a couple of months in Korea, and a lot of countries in between. And it just opened my eye to a whole different world, basically. It was literally a whole new world.
Dude, you are a marketer at heart. Disney brainwashed you on that damn ride, huh?
I learned from the best.
But, you know, going back to when Vodafone could only offer you a marketing role and not an engineering role, had that not happened, I mean, think about the opportunities you would have missed out on. When life gives you lemons.
Yeah, making a lemonade stand.
So this lemonade stand you built, Ahmed, it was, what, 9 years of traveling the world in a marketing role?
So by now it's 11. I have 9 years in Cairo and 2 years in London basically across the world. And in every single country I land in, there were two very clear things I do when I land. First thing, I text my family, landed safely in country X. And then I search for Uber because I want to get to the hotel as fast as possible to shower or go to sleep so I can meet the next meeting. And for me, that was my first experience in every country I land in. The first person that really introduces me to the country is the Uber driver. And he or she would always tell me the stories about why they joined Uber and how it made their life better and how it unlocked a better earning for them. And this for me was very, very inspiring as well. How can a company operating out of Silicon Valley that has no cars, has no idea who these people are and just created a platform for them to earn? And I was fascinated with the idea and it kept haunting me of the amount of financial impact they have and amount of financial empowerment that these guys are going through just because of a platform that was created by a handful of engineers in San Francisco. And I decided enough is enough. And again, another conversation I had with a friend. I was in one of the trips. I was coming back to Cairo. And you get this thing when you're accustomed to living somewhere and you go to where you're coming from, when you're originally from, and you find things that are different, your mind tends to point them out. So I was having a discussion around how people drive in Cairo and how there's no sidewalk and people walk in the street and this is very outdated. And in London, there are traffic lights. How is this not happening now? And then he told me something that stuck with me. He told me, if you're not part of the solution, don't be part of the problem. And it was one of the second biggest lessons in my life because it stuck with me for a very long time. Because here I am leaving the country, living elsewhere, and just criticizing the people that stayed. and it did not make any sense to me. So these two things together.
Yeah, man, I just want to stop you there. It's a common theme, right? I mean, just looking back at some of the founders we've spoken to on this podcast, I think about Dr. Ismail Bagi from The Gambia, Jude Salaskar from Haiti, Nelly Diop from Cameroon, and others. They found themselves outside of their home countries, part of their respective countries' diasporas. And eventually, with these new skill sets, new perspectives from being abroad, they decided to go back and solve these real, real problems their countries faced instead of staying outside of their countries and, I don't know what the word is, chastising their homeland.
100%. And it's to be honest, it's not really chastise. You don't do it out of malice. You do it out of habit. You're used to a couple of things by living there. And then all of a sudden it's changed and your mind is very good and your eye is very good at spotting differences in those small things. And it's uncontrollable. It just as a force of habit, you just point out the things that you're not used to. So, but his words were brilliant. It just stuck with me.
Stuck with you, huh? So what'd you do? Pack your bags for Cairo?
So I decided, you know what? I'm going to pack my bags and go back and see how can I be part of the solution. And I started to put the two and two together and come back to the region and join a ride-hailing company. And I ended up taking the job at Uber as head of marketing for Uber. Again, by complete coincidences. Yeah, I head up marketing for Uber Cairo for 9 months and then moved to Dubai to head up marketing for Uber Eats MENA. When this took me to Dubai, managed Saudi and managed Egypt, and then came back to Egypt as head of marketing for the general manager for the foods business in Egypt for at least 5 months. And then COVID hit and Uber decided they want to exit the foods business in the region. And that was my first experience of shutting down a business.
Man, you say it so casually, right? I mean, you're the GM. You're shutting down a massive operation in Cairo, a massive city, probably with a massive team. Can you talk about it?
It's challenging, I have to say. There's multiple aspects of it. There's the people aspect, which for me is the dearest. There's a lot of people that are impacted by that decision. And trying to make sure that you do right by the people, make sure that they land on solid footing, so you're able to help them connect them to the next position, or just ensure that they have a nice, decent severance package so they can have a bit of financial security until they find what's next. So this took a bit of time just to get things right. And then second thing, there's a lot of partners as well that their livelihood was impacted because a lot of restaurants were relying on Uber Eats to deliver. And then all of a sudden you're depriving them of that financial opportunity. So making sure that you handhold them throughout the transition and get it out of the way. You had the same impact on drivers who are delivering the food. So a lot of very different small moving pieces. You need to manage and you need to get it right and you need to make sure that any money that is owed by the company gets settled very quickly. Trying to have a smooth landing for most of the people, 100%. There were people that were impacted negatively by this, but you try to do the best you can under the circumstances. And it was very eye-opening. It was heart-wrenching, but it was very... you look back and realize that almost everybody landed in a much better position. And you understand that these things happen. There are ebbs and flows. And sometimes you're part of the ebb, sometimes you're part of the flow.
Yeah, well, I would have thought with COVID in a world of ebbs and flows, and Uber Eats business would have been in a flow state, booming with everyone stuck at home ordering food instead of going out. Am I wrong?
If you look at it this way, definitely does not make sense. But if you look at it from a holistic perspective, Uber was still hemorrhaging a lot of money on the rides business. And for them to finance another business that was still growing or still being built on the food business did not make sense financially. So they refocused at the core. So they divested all of the non-profitable or non-leading markets on the food side and focused on their core, their rides business. So again, it was a decision that was made for the benefit of the most at the impact of the few. So you understand it outside in, but for the few that were impacted, It was definitely a hard time.
All right, fine. So you're out of this job. It's COVID. What'd you do?
I had no idea what's going to happen next. I thought, you know what, I'm going to take a couple of months off, enjoy my first break in God knows what, how many years. And then I got approached by a couple of positions. One of them that really excited me, which was a launcher for Delivery Hero business, a dark stores business for Otlop. And I joined them, spent 8 months with them, helped them set up the business, hire 300 people.
Sorry, that was Delivery Hero's Otlop?
Delivery Hero's Otlop, yes.
Yeah, I haven't spent enough time in Egypt. What's Otlop?
Otlop was the Egyptian brand that was taken over by Talabat.
All right. And so for those who don't know, Talabat is a big Middle East food delivery service, right, Ahmed?
Yeah.
And so what? You're there getting all of these ex-restaurants you had on Uber Eats to then come onto the Delivery Hero Talabat platform?
No, because I was on the, that would have been great, but most of them were already on Talabat or Otlop. And I was more in charge of setting up the grocery side of this of the business. So I came in, I did the role that was asked of me, which is build a dark stores business, build a team, build a business, build an operating model. And then I decided, come summer, I'm going to step down, enjoy a couple of months by the sea, and see what the future holds.
Okay, and you mentioned now dark stores. Give us some context. What is a dark store?
So a dark store is basically a micro fulfillment center. There is a, it's if a small supermarket and a warehouse got married, a dark store is what would be the child. It's halfway in between. So it's a retail that has aisles, that has light. It's not dark at all. It has fridges and freezers. It's clean. And at the same time, it has the orientation or how it's built is like a warehouse. So it's very heavy on shelving and racks, and it's not focused on display because there is no customer walk-ins. So this is a business that is built around having multiple micro fulfillment centers in every neighborhood and being able to fulfill from that.
So to make it simple, it's the ghost kitchen of grocery stores. Yeah. As a consumer, I don't go there to shop, but instead a delivery guy picks up my groceries from this dark store and then brings them to me.
100%.
All right. So I've got some context. So what happens after you leave Delivery Hero?
So after 8 months with the Delivery Hero's Otlop and setting the dark stores business, I decided I'm going to step down, spend a couple of months by the beach and see what the future is going to do. To be honest, I got fond by having a summers off. So I decided I'm going to take another summer off. I've done my part. I've built the business and I've handed it over to more great people that can run it efficiently. And then in one of those days, I was sitting at home doing absolutely nothing. Opened the fridge, found nothing at home, and decided, you know what, I'm going to order the fastest food that's going to come. And halfway through the meal, the guilt hit me, you know, the calories guilt.
Oh, I know it all right.
Damn the calories guilt, man.
Damn the calorie guilt indeed.
100%. And at this moment, you know, you question, why didn't you go with something healthy? Why didn't you get a salad or a banana? And the answer was very simple, because a burger comes faster than a banana. And it's that moment that it hit me. It did not make any sense. Operation, the burger has to be made, but the banana is literally there. How can a burger get delivered faster than a banana?
Well, you'd like to think that the burger isn't already made.
Yeah, good point. So I had a conversation with a couple of friends that I considered smarter than me. And through the conversations, we thought that it's not only about the banana. There's a lot of very different customer needs that should get fulfilled faster than a burger, but it's not. And it's not a matter of, it cannot be done. It's just hard and nobody has thought about it before. And that's why me and my three brilliant co-founders decided to start Rabbit, which is on-demand retail. Whatever you want gets delivered in under 20 minutes faster than a burger.
What was the first step?
So basically, we did a lot of customer research. We started to see what the customer problems were. And one of the biggest things we came out very quickly on is to be able to promise something that is that tight on time. We're looking at 1,200 seconds. You need to take control of the entire cycle.
1,200 seconds, huh? Yeah, I guess that is 20 minutes.
My math stands out. So the way you look at it is you have to control the entire cycle. So We're not a marketplace player. We're not an over-the-top player, which is the completely against the complete opposite of what Uber did. So we have our own dark stores. We have our own micro fulfillment centers. And a dark store is a hybrid between what a retail and a dark and a warehouse should be. It's exactly in the middle. So we procure our own products. We store them in our dark stores and we use our own riders to deliver the product. So we take control of the entire of the cycle. And this is the only way we can continue to shave off seconds and guarantee a customer with a magical experience of from click to door in under 20 minutes.
Yeah, so this really interests me, Ahmed. It's not that you'd just be a marketplace, a broker, if you will, that simply connects shopper and grocery store and outsources the delivery, no less. But instead, you'd be selling your products from your warehouse delivered by your staff. Why? Why was it for you so important to control the entire supply chain from dark store to consumer?
When you look at it, we looked at a lot of the pain points of the customer. So one of the pain points is definitely the ability to get things fast. And the second is the certainty and the peace of mind that what you order is going to come. And a lot of the marketplace players are unable to guarantee that just because they don't hold the inventory and they don't control it. So what the beauty about our model is anything that's available in the dark store, you find it on the app. So if you put it in your basket, you expect it to happen at your doorstep. No calls, no substitution, no challenges. So it just gives the customer that peace of mind.
Yeah, that's a good point. So I wouldn't be a customer of yours, right? Sorry, I don't ever order groceries. But the one time I ever did, it was with InstaShop here in Dubai. Man, this was years ago. And after I submitted my order, they called me saying like three of the things I wanted weren't available. And I'm saying to myself, like, then why the hell do you offer them to me, right? I guess it's because, well, it's not their stock, right? They don't have any idea what's available and what's not.
Exactly. Because the marketplace players cannot hold the stock there. So it's one of my problems. I have three dogs, and every time I start my shopping experience, I start with the dog food because basically I can eat wherever. And after 30 minutes of the order, I get a notification saying or somebody calling me that this and this and this is out of stock. And accordingly, I have to take my entire basket to somewhere else. And it's just a chore to buy something. And this was the second biggest insight that stood out for us is customers want predictability. So not only predictability on time, but predictability if I buy something, I expect to get it.
Okay, so you want to offer your customers speed, that is click to delivery in 1200 seconds, and predictability, that is what I order is what I get. How would you start?
Hire amazing people.
And how would you afford all these amazing people?
So we went out fundraising, and we were very lucky to be able to excite enough people about what we want to build and the vision and just the caliber of the co-founders. Between the four of us, we have more than 75 years of experience in retail and in tech. So we managed to convince amazing people to back us. We managed to raise $11 million of pre-seed, and that just gave us the capital and the liquidity to be able to build the right experience for customers and hire amazing talents to solve that problem.
Man, I love how you just dropped that in so casually. $11 million in pre-seed. Ahmed, this was the biggest pre-seed raise in Middle East history. And you did it, what, based only off of an idea? This was pre-launch, right?
That was post presentation, pre everything.
Look, man, it's impressive. It's a testament to you as a founder, to your vision, your team, your idea. But let's be honest, $11 million pre-seed before shipping product? I'm sure you see VC Twitter, you see startup Twitter really shitting on these ridiculous, insane, eight-figure pre-seed rounds based on a presentation. I gotta ask you, at risk of sounding belittling, patronizing, man, there's a problem here, no? Am I fair in saying that?
I think it's fair. But again, it's one of those things. We have a very fringe experience. We're not the norm, we're the anomaly. But from what I understood so far is when it comes to pre-seed, or when it comes to very early stage, the guts behind an investor is investing in the talent and not the idea. Because if you're a smart enough founder and the idea doesn't work, you'll pivot and you'll do something smarter with the money. So we're really investing in the people and not investing in the idea, because ideas come and go. It's about execution. It's about brains. So for it to make sense is it needs a longer time to be able to assess an idea, which is the reason why it's a very different world before product market fit or when you actually reach enough customers that can validate the idea. So all of that is more art than science. And then post that, it's more science. So it gets validated very clearly.
Yeah, on the topic of validation, I think a huge reason, aside from founder talent, that VCs are okay writing these huge pre-seed checks, especially in these emerging and frontier markets. I mean, look at TAM, right? Cairo itself, what's the population?
We're guessing it's somewhere around 20 million.
Right. So with a pretty nascent market in food delivery, investors say, well, all right, Ahmed, if you get a decent chunk of market share, eventually there's got to be a unicorn in there somewhere, no? Given the population metrics. So let me get in as soon as I can. But what else? Ahmed, talk to me about Cairo. Aside from a huge population, what is it about the city that investors would think a grocery delivery app would work?
There's a lot of disposable income. There's traffic is a pain, so people want to save time any left, right, and center. And this is what Rabbit promises. We just deliver the peace of mind. We deliver it quickly so you don't worry about those things.
Okay, fine. So you've got this idea. You've got this funding.
We hired a team. We started constructions and we broke ground literally in building our own business. So we built, so far we're covering 6 neighborhoods. And we signed a lot of deals with suppliers, with manufacturers, with producers, just to make sure we avail those products onto the customer platform and onto the customer. And we built the tech to be able to put that thing together. And that all of that took us a total of 130 days from idea to launch. And again, that's a testament to all of the busy rabbits that have done that. We've managed collectively to build a company that is built around speed and getting things faster, fast right, better than perfect late. That's how we look at it.
Say that again.
It's better to do it fast right than do it perfect late.
Fast right, perfect late. So in your really fast 130 days from idea to launch, walk me through that timeline.
So our first day when we decided we're going to start this company and we shook hands was the 6th of June. And our first order came in from customer on the 15th of October. And throughout those 130 days, we barely got any sleep. But it was just very energizing. The mission of trying to bring something to life that nobody has ever seen before. How can I order something and it arrives in under 1,200 seconds. And we managed to ship that experience in 130 days. And now we don't only carry groceries, we carry cosmetics, we carry some basic fashion, electronics. So there's a lot of very different things we bring into our vision of unlocking on-demand retail.
Now back to your mantra of fast right, not perfect late. I have to imagine by being that fast, you couldn't have been right all the time, every delivery.
No, definitely. I think one of the nicer discussions I had with our CTO and the tech team was always, guys, we're going to launch in 130 days with the MVP. But our definition of MVP at Rabbit is the maximum viable product. So we always keep pushing. And at the same time, we're very happy that things break. So I think our customers that believed in us and tried us in the first couple of weeks, they had a subpar experience because a lot of things broke. The tech broke.
So what? Customers got their orders in 1,201 seconds?
No. Some customers got their order in 40 minutes. So you're looking at 2,400 seconds. So no, it wasn't great. Some things broke, but we learned a lot. We learned how to optimize our operations. We learned how to better predict demand. And at the same time, we kept refining our tech just to make sure we get the customer experience where it needs to be. When we started the business, we thought that customer experience has to be at front and center of everything. So one of the things we put in mind is how do we get everything as fast as possible with very minimal human interaction? So once you order, it just shows up. Nobody asks you anything. You don't get another notification, nothing. It just tells you it's at the door.
All right. So let's get to the nuts and bolts of your business model, Ahmed. Let's first talk about supply. You're sourcing grocery products from distributors, producers?
We buy them from producers. So fresh fruits and vegetables, we buy them directly from producers. We buy a lot of local items and we buy the CPGs from their manufacturers and importers. So we try to cut the middleman as much as possible so we can get the customers with the best pricing available.
All right. And on the consumer side, okay, I'm in Cairo. let's say I'm staying in Heliopolis. You guys have a warehouse there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I order a banana, some bread, some meat. I head on the app, place my order. What happens?
The way we run the business is there is what we call under the roof and on the road. So under the roof, we manage it through our rabbit pickers. And once the customer places an order, the under the roof tech manages the order and manages the experience to make sure that the rabbit picker can pick and pack the order in under 70 seconds. And then regardless of the amount of order, items in the order, and then on the road, takes us around 10 to 12 minutes to deliver through another rabbit rider. And that guarantees the entire experience happening in under 20 minutes.
So a picker picks up my groceries in 70 seconds, and the rabbit has the remaining, what, 1,130 seconds to bring it to me?
Yeah, it's a marathon relay team.
Yeah, man. 2024 Olympics.
I wish.
Now back to business. As a consumer, I go to a Carrefour down the street, or I order on Rabbit. My banana, my bread, my meat, same price? Or would Rabbit be more expensive?
Same price, because we don't have a lot of overheads. The business is very slim. There's not a lot of fat for the business. At the same time, we procure directly from producers and suppliers and manufacturers. So there's not a lot of fat on top of that. And the entirety of the model is very no frills, basically. So we are able to give customers a very competitive pricing that is really, really, really at par with the Carrefours of the world.
Got it, man. Yeah, faster speed, more convenient, same price. So in the, 3 months that you've been live, tell me, how are numbers?
So we just released our end-of-year newsletter that has all of the infographic around the numbers. So basically, in our 75 days of operation in 2021, we've managed to serve more than 10,000 customers. We've managed to deliver more than 100,000 items to consumers. And the fun fact I like is our riders drove more than 80,000 kilometers in 2021 alone, which is more than 2 full trips around the world, which is a testament to how customers love the product, because it just takes their mind off the anxiety of wanting to buy something. There's always that, oh shit moment, I forgot that, or oh shit moment, I forgot that. And then it became very quickly the habit for customers to get their items in rather than buy them in bulk and go through a lot of waste. They just buy what they exactly need, and accordingly, they consume better and they consume healthier.
Now I get that, right? I get getting things on time. I get the whole get a banana in a faster amount of time than getting a hamburger. I get the whole 1,200 minutes thing.
1,200 seconds, 1,200 minutes. Oh, man, that's the, I could sleep better if it's 1,200 minutes.
Shit, my bad. 1,200 minutes, I guess we'd be talking about Uber Eats. So, by the way, what was your on-time success rate? I mean, 20 minutes ain't a long time for click to delivery.
In 2021, we managed to deliver more than 93% in less than 20 minutes.
And what, if it's late, it's free?
Currently, we do compensate customers if we get things wrong, because, again, we believe first in transparency and more importantly, customer experience.
All right, so back to what I was trying to ask earlier. Ahmed, I get this whole on-demand convenience thing. I do. But it's a race, it seems, amongst these food and grocery delivery platforms that when one company raises like $1 billion seed on delivering food to you in 15 minutes, another will raise a $2 billion seed on delivering in 14 minutes. Is this not just all a bit ridiculous?
A couple of years ago, if you wanted to listen to a piece of music, you'd search for a CD. A couple of decades ago, if you wanted to watch a movie, you search for a film. And now, if you want a taxi, just click a button and it appears. It's on-demand that's taking over music, entertainint, and ride-hailing. And I believe that on-demand is going to take over the world. People are getting more stressed about time. People are getting more efficient, and they want to do more with their day. And just unlocking that peace of mind and unlocking that on-demand experience across retail is not what we're trying to push down customers. It's what customers really want. And we've seen that in the data. Customers, when they try, they're very skeptical about it. It's exactly, why should I buy a smartphone? I had a phone at home and it worked fine. And once you buy it, nobody's said, you know what, I'm going to go back to my home phone again. Once you try it, you get the experience why is it different and why it makes your life simpler, and the peace of mind and the certainty that what you order, you get in a specific time window, no surprises, at a great price, is just an experience that you always wonder why it wasn't there before.
Yeah, I agree. I agree we are heading to this on-demand world. I just don't see how perhaps in more developed markets where there are like five delivery companies all going after the same market share, raising on the premise of speed. Is speed for you that important? I mean, Ahmed, what does 1,200 seconds mean to you?
For me, it translates into giving customers their time back. So one of the dearest metrics that we've looked at in our 75 days of operation in 2021 is we've managed collectively to save our customers more than a year's of time. And in the modern world, that's a lot. So if you look at it, being born in this side of the world, you don't get access to the best education. You don't get access to the best earning opportunities. And accordingly, and it's very hard for you to travel. And if Rabbit can unlock a bit more time for you to invest that extra time into whatever makes you progress better in life and gives you that peace of mind, then we've done a bit of good to the world. And hopefully Rabbit can play a very small part there.
That's really well said. And it'd be really cool to see if you can also offer products, services, trainings, I don't know, for folks to leverage the time saved when ordering with Rabbit. So with that in mind, Ahmed, we talk a year from now. Where will Rabbit be?
Hopefully everywhere.
Yeah.
So it all comes from our name. We call the company Rabbit because rabbits multiply quickly. Rabbits are very hard to catch and they're very fast. And rabbits have the keen ability to dig rabbit holes and tunnels that pop up everywhere. And hopefully I see Rabbit as the combination of three. One, to hire a lot of smart people and grow fast. One, to be everywhere and want to be very fast and very hard to catch.
And plans of having a seed raise?
No, definitely. We're very ambitious and we're very adamant on making sure we avail the rabbit magic to as many people as possible. So even though we've raised $11 million, I think that's the start of our journey. And we have a lot of people that have booked a ticket on the rocket ship. So let's take that ship to the moon.
And Ahmed, as you go to the moon, which I have no doubt you will, what's your message to the aspiring Egyptian entrepreneur listening right now?
First thing, don't start a company because it's very hard unless you believe in the mission and you believe in the problem you want to solve. It has to be very dear. Don't focus about raising about a big check. Don't focus on the TechCrunch article headline. Focus on building a solid business, solid fundamentals, and keep pushing, dream big. And I think that's the biggest advice. We're very limited in this region by how big we dream. If you talk to people in Silicon Valley, their dream is not changing the experience for people in California or even New York. They think about how can they change the experience in China and India and all over the world. And we're only limited by how big we dream. So think of don't start a company unless you believe fully in the problem and you want to dedicate a big chunk of your life to solving that. Don't chase big headlines and big checks. Chase what makes the company strong and dream big. Dream, the bigger you dream, the more you can run faster.
Like a rabbit.
Like a rabbit, always.
That was Ahmed Yousry from Rabbit. Not from Silicon Valley, but from Egypt. New episodes of the podcast are released every other week, so be sure to subscribe to, share, and rate, review Not From Silicon Valley on Apple, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Thanks again. We'll see you soon.